America, center of equal daughters, equal sons.
This very early wire recording is thought to be of Walt Whitman himself reading his poem America. You can just make out the words strong, ample, fair, enduring.
Strong, ample, fair, enduring, capable.
Ezra Pound called Walt Whitman America's poet, and Whitman believed his poetry could heal the nation in the years leading up to the Civil War. And during the Civil War, Whitman actually devoted himself to healing thousands of wounded soldiers. He held them, dressed their wounds, wrote their letters home, and even spoon-fed them ice cream. I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason. Later on today's show, we're marking the 200th anniversary of another great American author, Edgar Allan Poe. While Poe's stories seem gloomy and depressing, he was actually a great idealist.
His famous horror stories are always, or nearly always, laced with a satiric and comic element that many people don't recognize.
But first, Walt Whitman is best known for the 1855 groundbreaking book of poems Leaves of Grass. Mara Scanlon and Brady Earnhardt are fans of Whitman and professors of English at Mary Washington University in Fredericksburg, where Whitman first saw the violence of the Civil War. He spent the rest of the war nursing thousands of wounded soldiers back to health. Brady, let me start with you. What first gave him prominence as a writer? Was it Leaves of Grass?
There are a couple of ways of answering that. One is that the book he wrote that sold more copies of it than anything else during his lifetime was his temperance novel, Franklin Evans, that he put out in 1842. But after that, there's this sort of historical black hole in the late 40s. And then all of a sudden, in 1855, he comes out with this groundbreaking book called Leaves of Grass. And it's so remarkable that Ralph Waldo Emerson, who is the highest paid lecturer in the country, who's one of these famous, famous figures, writes him a letter. I greet you at the beginning of a great career. It's the most famous letter in American literary history. And what does Whitman do? But he takes this letter and leaks it to friends of his in the press so that it gets published without Emerson's permission. Whitman goes further and publishes I Greet You at the Beginning of a Great Career on the spine of the second edition of Leaves of Grass in 1856.
He's a shameless self-promoter.
Yeah, that's one of those terrible contradictions, or wonderful contradictions, as the case may be about Whitman.
So on one hand, we have Emerson saying, I greet you at the beginning of a fabulous career. And then you have prominent critics calling the work disgusting.
Yeah. Well, I think there's two things about it. One is that the form burst through what would be considered well-made poetry of the time in those long, lengthy, prosy lines of Whitman's. That would not have been seen as good poetry in a way. And then also the things he wrote about were inappropriate for what Brady was calling that kind of schlocky, sentimental poetry of the time. To make a list of Americans that includes not only the president and his cabinet, but also opium eaters and prostitutes, to write about sexuality, about slavery, about his own body, it's all material that would not have been seen as decorous, appropriate material for poetry.
Emily Dickinson's friend and sometime editor, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, asked her if she'd read Walt Whitman's work, and she said, why, of course I haven't read it, but I've heard it's disgraceful. And anyway, one of the things that people found disgraceful was the way that Whitman talked about the female body, which he was trying to desensationalize and sort of de-smutify sex.
I think that's true of his discussion of the body altogether. And the individual human body comes to also stand for him for the national body, which he was very, very interested in speaking for and representing. And this passage I'm about to read talks about his desire to represent these people who otherwise are not represented in poetry. You hear how explicit he insists on what he's going to include. Through me, many long, dumb voices voices of the interminable generations of slaves, voices of prostitutes and of deformed persons, voices of the diseased and despairing and of thieves and dwarves, through me forbidden voices, voices of sexes and lusts, voices veiled, and I remove the veil. Copulation is no more rank to me than death is. Seeing, hearing, and feeling are miracles, and each part and tag of me is a miracle. The scent of these armpits is aroma finer than prayer. This head is more than churches or Bibles or creeds. And hear how revolutionary that claim is even today. And the sweeping rhetoric of that poetry, you can imagine it being declaimed that the poetry might accomplish something that traditional politics, which he was getting less enamored of at that time, just weren't going to heal the nation the way the right poet might just do.
And the healing you're talking about is the build-up to the Civil War. The Civil War really changes him. What was his role during the Civil War?
Well, he was deeply concerned about the fracturing of the country that was happening in the years that led up to the Civil War. As it became clear that the South and the North were not going to reconcile without a fight, he became a staunch unionist. And he actually, like a lot of people in the North, welcomed the war and became even sort of shockingly bloodthirsty war booster, because he saw that he thought of this as a process that was going to cleanse the country.
Whitman was initially drawn into the fighting areas of the Civil War by the wounding of his brother George, George Washington Whitman. But he was wounded at the Battle of Fredericksburg, where thousands and thousands of men died in a day because they were directed to march up from the river through what were then open plains. The Confederates were entrenched behind a wall and in very protected positions and just mowed them down. Walt Whitman and his mother saw George's name in a paper, realized he might be wounded but didn't know how, and Walt traveled to Fredericksburg to find his brother. He was very shocked to see the wounded there. Spent a good part of the day in a large brick mansion on the banks of the Rappahannock, used as a hospital since the battle. Outdoors, at the foot of a tree, within 10 yards of the front of the house, I notice a heap of amputated feet, legs, arms, hands, etc., a full load for a one-horse cart. Several dead bodies lie near, each covered with its brown woolen blanket. And so he finds his brother there, spends a few days among the soldiers, heads to D.C., and essentially I think the best way to say it is he felt a calling to remain among the Civil War soldiers as, he called himself a spiritual missionary, a soldier's missionary, he called himself a wound dresser to actually Confederate and Union soldiers in those hospitals for the next several years, for the duration of the war and beyond.
After the war, he wrote, "In my visits to the hospitals, I found it was in the simple matter of personal presence and emanating ordinary cheer and magnetism that I succeeded and helped more than by medical nursing or anything else." He would write letters to their moms for them. He would bring them tobacco or whiskey or
ice cream.
He would pet them. He would give them ice cream.
And he embraced them quite a bit. I mean, he records over and over, you know, "I sat with this man and I held his hand. I hugged him. I kissed him. I embraced him. They reach for me. They want me to kiss them and embrace them." Those soldiers came to represent for him a camaraderie that he saw as the best possible form of national unity and democracy. But then other times it becomes so personal. This section, for instance, is called "A Case from Second Bull Run." "Poor John Mahi is dead. He died yesterday. His was a painful and long, lingering case. The bladder had been perforated by a bullet going entirely through him. Not long since, I sat a good part of the morning by his bedside, Ward E, Armory Square. The water ran out of his eyes from the intense pain, and the muscles of his face were distorted, but he uttered nothing except a low groan now and then. Poor Mahi, a mere boy in age, but old in misfortune. He never knew the love of parents, was placed in his infancy in one of the New York charitable institutions, and subsequently bound out to a tyrannical master in Sullivan County, the scars of whose cowhide and club remained yet on his back. His wound here was a most disagreeable one, for he was a gentle, cleanly, and affectionate boy.
Whitman was what we would term now homosexual. How did his sexuality play into his experience nursing soldiers?
Oh, that's a really sad, the sad story, because it was an occupational hazard when he was working in the hospitals to fall in love with soldiers. And he did so all the time. Fall in love is maybe an exaggeration. There were a couple of soldiers in particular, though, that he was very drawn to and who seemed to have been sort of uncertain as to how to respond. They weren't used to somebody coming on to them so strong. And one in particular named Tom Sawyer, Whitman seems to have pursued pretty diligently, and Walt would write him letters that said things like, "Tom, you know, didn't you get my last letter that had the self-addressed envelope on it?"
Right.
So you could write back to him. Just, yeah, oh, it's so painful.
I agree with that. And yet I also think that that it is really pathetic at times. And then at other times, I think it's beautiful, because Brady was talking before about how he was living out what he had written about before. And here we find somebody who's relating to these suffering human beings with all of himself, his desire, his affection, his literary ability, his intellect.
Absolutely.
All of those things that he can bring to them, and he does all of it. And so while some soldiers record home in letters, you know, this uncle figure, fatherly figure, you know, one soldier uses the phrase, "He kissed me like a girl," or he, you know, "I kissed him for at least half a minute, you know.
Yeah.
But that doesn't seem to have disturbed most of them. I'm very moved by the physical and erotic nature of his relationship to those soldiers, which doesn't seem predatory to me. But
right. On the other hand, I think part of what makes it beautiful is the fact that it felt incomplete on some level, right? That's the
right.
Incompleteness is the soul of romance. And in some of his letters, Whitman says to these soldiers, to some of the, I think Tom Sawyer is mm-hmm. one of them, he says, "I will never be truly happy unless you and I are living under the same roof, and, you know, maybe we can find a farm somewhere," that kind of thing, which of course never happened.
It's such a shame, isn't it, that most of us who aren't scholars have our first introduction to Whitman and maybe the card game Authors.
Right.
Here you see this imposing bearded figure, and you think, I don't know who the heck Walt Whitman is, but it can't be great.
Yeah, right. He seems like a little bit of a, you know, a nut job. And
we should redo that deck of cards.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's true of so much about literature. I think that sometimes students and other readers forget that every reader can do the same thing to a piece of literature, can make it breathe.
There's something about Whitman's, though, that's more so than I think other authors.
Why
I think
do you
it was
think?
Robert Louis Stevenson, I think it was, said that Whitman was able to make you feel as you read one of his poems like he was standing over your shoulder, looking down with you at the text. His work is full of phrases like, "Listener up there, come closer to me. Loaf with me on the grass," and this really famous passage. This is from a poem called "So Long." "From behind the screen where I hid, I advance personally. Camarado, this is no book. Who touches this touches a man. Is it night? Are we here alone? It is I you hold, and who holds you? I spring from the pages into your arms. Decease calls me forth." This idea of who touches this touches a man. You know, you do feel like, oh, this is a person that I have here.
Brady, you perform a song as a singer and guitar player called Whitman in 1863. That's a song whose words, I'm guessing, are letters from Whitman.
The gist of it is he's writing a letter to Tom Sawyer, the soldier that he's infatuated with, maybe in love with, and it's not the first letter he's written, and he kind of knows that Tom's not going to write back, and he knows that Tom is not going to return the kind of love that he has.
It's interesting to have such a personal song, a love song, in the midst of the national schism.
Yeah,
but it does. I mean, it gets to a lot of what we've been saying about Whitman in the midst of the Civil War. That is that he understood himself both to be a wound dresser to the nation as a whole, who could find in his poetry a new map for how to proceed, and also that on the most intimate level, he straightened the collars and wrote the letters and fed the ice cream, you know, to individuals, and understood that in some ways something we all have to be willing to do if we're going to survive as a nation, I think. That is, you can't always change things on a national scale, but sometimes you can spoon some ice cream to the sick and tired person next to you.
Brady Earnhardt and Mara Scanlon are professors of English at the University of Mary Washington. With their colleague James Groom, they're working on Looking for Whitman, a digital humanities project. For a link, visit our website at withgoodreasonradio.org. Coming up next, Edgar Allan Poe at 200.
A crowd came in last week from Fredericksburg. I met a soldier close to you. He brought the sniper's ball that missed your charming head. The day the bridge you built went through, think of you by some campfire, sleeping or lying in your tent wake, thinking out how you might write me what you couldn't say.